Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the programme that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today on University Matters, Mr. Edwin Ward. He's a visiting lecturer at the Institute of Tourism, Travel and Culture here at the University, and quite a few other things at the same time. He's started off his life as a lawyer, as an LLB from the University of Dundee in Scotland, but decided then to turn his talents in other directions. Advertising and public relations veteran, copywriter and presenter, Mr. Ward is a Scotsman like his mentor David Ogilvie, founding, amongst other activities, the current Ogilvie operations in Malta. He's worked over the years with many well-known companies that are really household names. Mr. Ward has pioneered the use of a semiotic square, which I'd love to hear about, in the hospitality industry, preparing the brand identity for one of Malta's largest luxury hotels. He was co-organiser of the Commonwealth Corporate Governance Conference, together with the Commonwealth Secretariat in London, and is currently involved in several marketing initiatives here on the island. He's run workshops on branding for the Institute of Directors and is, as I said, a visiting lecturer on brand identity and brand image here at the University. He works on product development, communication, brand lifecycle positioning problems, customer relationship management. He has a passion for brand identity as the core element in consumer engagement, and I look forward to discussing some of those points with him. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Patricia.
I think possibly it's best to start with a very basic definition, perhaps, just to put branding in a context. Branding, what is it in a word?
No one knows.
I feared you were going to tell me something like that.
There's lots of different opinions on this. As the years have gone by, probably since the 1950s, when brands were first talked about in a serious way, David Ogilvie was one of the first people to talk about brands. And he defined it as being the sum of a number of intangibles. Today in the 21st century, we're not too far away from that kind of definition. But what we say is a brand is an expression of an identity. So that's it in a nutshell.
But it must be quite difficult for a big company that perhaps has several branches, several areas of work, to actually home in on this one identity.
Yeah, you see this fuzziness, mostly, let's say, in the local market. HSBC is a good example of fuzziness. They are operating in business to business, business to consumer. They're not quite sure really what they're projecting as such to the local audience in these different guises. And this is because their brand identity has evolved from a period in the 90s where they took over hundreds of banks all around the world, MidMed Bank being one of them. And they just weren't too sure what to do next in order to bring it all under one umbrella. So they are learning about brands, and this in a sense shows you how different sectors are at different stages of maturity in terms of understanding what brand assets are and how they can make use of them.
How much in branding is to do with your competitors rather than you? How much, when you are creating an identity for a company, how much is it important to look around and look at the competition? Or are you just concentrating on that particular company?
You must always with any brand, look inwards. If you go back to the basic definition, the expression of an identity, so a brand is the expression of an identity. If that identity is not unique, it can never have competitive advantage. So it's the formulation, it's the chemistry, if you like, behind the brand identity, which allows it to flourish and be focused in the marketplace. Do you look at your competitors? Hopefully not. Hopefully what you are doing is driven by ideas and values which take you forward rather than the competition forcing you to respond to their changes. In most of those cases, the brand owner would not be the market leader if they are responding to what other brands are doing around them in the marketplace. So a leading brand sets the tone for a market.
When you're creating this brand for a company, the thing that the public sees immediately, well, sort of three things really, I suppose, the logo, which we can talk about, the slogan as well, and the aims, the sort of the mission statement, perhaps, which might not be of particular interest to the ordinary man in the street, but certainly if somebody's investing in a company, then obviously the mission statement would be important. How do you sort of link those together, or are they linked? I mean, presumably they are.
If you take any brand, the word brand could be compiled from a number of different definitions of ideas. So you spoke about mission, you spoke about vision, but you could also speak about more important things. Brand promise. A brand is a guarantee of performance, and without having the promise built into the basic brand proposition, then really it can have very little force in terms of the internal organization working with and developing the brand to take it outwards. And that can be anywhere in the product development life cycle or in the marketing life cycle. And equally on the other side, the consumer should, if you're doing your job well and you're doing it with a degree of authenticity, because this is another aspect of brands, being authentic, being original, being unique, they should become engaged with your mission. All brands are subjected to what we call the consumer disposition funnel, and that is something which at the very lowest level would be you're aware of a brand's existence, and at the highest level you've become so enamored by a brand and you buy it so often and you're so loyal that you become an advocate for the brand and you spread the word of mouth.
So you mentioned authenticity, reliability. These are all things which a company needs to be putting across. This message that it's putting across about itself has to be about being true to that slogan that it is projecting.
A slogan can be understood in a variety of ways. Politicians have used slogans probably for about the last 100 years or so. Although if you go back into ancient history and read Ovid, those days were also the days when slogans were made and not adhered to. So standing four square behind anything that you put into the market, that's absolutely vital. And some people have come a cropper because of this. So Avis had a campaign in the 1960s where they said, we try harder. And then the competition came back and said, well, we're the people that they have to try harder to be. So a slogan is a double-edged sword. I don't believe in slogans, but I do believe that if you say what you're about in a in an attractive way, in an engaging way, in a way that touches people, then it's more likely to be believed and accepted.
Let's look at the livery for a moment of the company, starting with the logo. When I was doing communications at university, we had a lecturer who gave us a credit or part of a credit on logos. And the opening gambit of this lecturer's talk was a picture of the eight-pointed cross of the Knights of St. John. So, talking about history, not going back to Ovid, but going back 500 years, you've got a logo there which must be one of the longest lasting logos in history. So I suppose that would be, it struck me as being a good example of a long lasting logo.
Yeah, symbols have been around for a long time to represent ideas or to represent organizations or associations or even collectives of ideas. We ran into trouble using the Maltese cross in the Far East. I shan't mention the name of the company involved, but effectively the feedback from the marketplace was, well, you know, why are you using this symbol of oppression in our country? So it does mean different things to different people. To Christians, it means something significant, but to the non-Christian also means something equally significant, but less attractive.
I can imagine that here in Malta, certainly, it keeps on being used and used and used again. Mm. And recognized. And recognized even in Western Europe, let's say Western Europe, so we don't get into the complications of using it in these. Western Europe, the meaning of it has actually lasted quite a long time.
What meaning would you say that?
Well, I thought you might ask me that. I'm supposed to be asking the questions here. Well, I suppose St. John's Ambulance has used it as well. So it's sort of...
It means rescue.
It means rescue to many people, I suppose. They looked at it. Anyway, but... In this credit, we did discuss logos, and I must say, when you start dissecting them and analysing them, I was never able to look at a logo again and just enjoy it for what it was. I now have to sort of sit there thinking, now, why did they put that brushstroke there, and why did they use that acronym or whatever, and why did they use that font? So it's rather ruined things for me. But
David used to tell us a great story about some of his most famous advertising, which were campaigns like the man with the Hathaway shirt, and the lead actor, Baron Wrangle was his name. He was an alcoholic who used to be tied to a pole, and he wore an eye patch. He was tied to a pole because he swayed during the photo shoot. So they tied him to a pole to keep him straight. And campaigns for Guinness, Rolls-Royce at 60 miles per hour was the headline. At 60 miles per hour, the loudest noise in the new Rolls-Royce is the sound of the electric clock. It's a great line, isn't it? And he used to say, well, you know, there were two ladies on the London bus saying, Sybil, did you notice that the headline on that advertisement was set in Gilsan? Of course, you know, these conversations never occur. And what's happening is that there's a set of subliminal triggers, if you like, which are educating the viewer about what they are looking at. And it may look sophisticated, it may look luxurious, it may look economy, it may look mid-market. And it takes teams of professionals to create those looks.
Yeah, I think that's I do like logos, and I do like slogans, and I still enjoy some of the less effective ones, really, and some of them that obviously somebody's thought was very good, but in actual fact is not.
Well, it's a factor of how much money you put behind it in certain cases, and many of them have evolved in less than linear ways. It's a good example of a less than linear development is Lever brothers back in the 40s and 50s. They called David one day after he set up the agency in New York and said, you know, we're launching a new product. Could you come and, you know, speak to us? And the reason he was in New York was to help British companies to get their products into the States post-war. So that was the purpose of the agency. That's why Ogilvy and Mather was actually set up. And he went on a factory visit with a few gentlemen wearing white lab coats and carrying clipboards and explaining all kinds of things about the factory to him. And eventually he said, well, you know, what's in that vat over there? And they said, oh, that's stearic acid, Mr. Ogilvy. He said, stearic acid? Isn't that the stuff that they put in ladies' cold cream? And they said, yes. He said, well, thank you very much for the tour. I'm off. And he got awfully excited and ran to the train station, reportedly with a couple of chaps in white lab coats trailing after him to find out what had gone wrong. Anyway, he got on board the train. He was heading back into New York, and he was so excited he got off the train and ran to a telephone on the platform and called the office. There were four people worked in the office. He said, Mary, I've had an idea. And she said, yes, Mr. Ogilvy. You know, that's how excited he used to get. Anyway, this particular idea is now on the, it's now preserved at our global headquarters in New York. And it simply says this, 1/4 moisturizing cream. So, do you know what the brand is?
Pons? I don't know.
Yeah, you're pretty close. It's Dove.
Dove.
And that's still our account today, over 50
really?
Years later. Yeah,
gosh.
60 years later. Yeah, 51.
That's a success story then.
And that was a positioning line. So that's the example of a positioning line, which is given life over a period of time, over generations, and where the positioning line frames the brand experience. So, you know, if you buy Dove New Age now or whatever product you happen to choose from Dove, you believe that the moisturizing element is built in. So there's a powerful positioning. Now, he could have equally positioned it as the soap for car mechanics. Mm. But he didn't. Stearic acid.
So positioning, once you've mentioned that particular expression, is another expression which is crops up quite a lot when you read branding literature. So positioning, it must be quite complicated actually to actually position rightly, because if you've got to get it right, because if it's going to last a lot of years, like this particular example of good positioning did, you've got to get it right.
You've got to get it right, and you've got to make it right. And you've got to stick with it, which if we talk about the local market, the market in Malta, there's a tendency to chop and change very rapidly when they think that something's not working as well as they want it to. But of course, it does take time to build any idea or any organization. So yesterday I was at a meeting yesterday evening in my spare time. And one of the attendees at this particular meeting, it was an AGM for Malta Rugby, said, do you know, gentlemen, that we've been doing this now for 30 years and we have, you know, whatever, grown to just over 400 members. So that's how long it takes to build an idea.
Yes, quite so.
The idea that we're going to do it overnight or that there's some miracle which can be performed, you know, the magic wand of the ad agency. These are unreasonable expectations from local entrepreneurs. And it's one of the dangers of being an SME. You can only see part of the picture.
In fact, that was going to be my next question, because we've mentioned sort of Jaguar and mentioned a couple of big name examples previously. But for SMEs, where the... here in Malta, the economy of return is very small. They're chasing after the same people. The temptation to do what you've just been describing, to change, to try and be flexible, to suit the market. It must be a great temptation for them to do that. Are there special things that SMEs as small companies have to be careful about?
Yeah, taking their blinkers off. The orientation for successful companies today is very different to what it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Malta was inside a bubble. Let's call it a protectionist bubble. It was hermetically sealed inside that bubble. And in the 80s, towards the end of the 80s, a window began to open at the top of this dome to let some competition back in. And markets, rather than being monolithic, became more pluralistic. Broadcasting is a good example. It has grown since the late 80s tremendously. At one point, there was an antenna, a booster, on practically every roof. Now it's a satellite dish. Local people love their media consumption. They were at one time avid readers of newspapers. Now they're avid readers of internet sites and social media channels and mobiles. So all those habits are there. But the local entrepreneurs must join the global race. Fishing in a market of 400,000 will never take Malta to the next level of economic development. And that's been the stifling element over the last 50 years. If you look at Singapore and Malta, they both approximately had the same GDP in the 60s. And the last time I checked, Singapore is now about 250 billion GDP, and Malta's about 6 billion. So this is MidMed and BOV all over again. You know, why did HSBC's management manage to squeeze more money out of the market? Well, part of the reason is that some of their business is internationally oriented, and that's why they perform better.
When things go wrong, and sometimes they do go horribly pear-shaped for any company, even the biggest, what are the rules? There must be a sort of a plan B when it comes to crises. What would you advise a company that has a problem to do first?
Well, number one is to believe in your brand. Without that asset, you know, a brand is the most valuable asset that any business can own. There's an old story from the Quaker Oats family, where during a board meeting, there was a discussion about perhaps different directors going their own way. And the chairman said, well, that's fine with me. You guys can have the factory, you can have the office, you can have the plant and machinery, you can have absolutely everything. The land on which this enterprise sits is all yours. Take it. I'll take the brand. And I'm sure I will do much better than you. And that's about 130 years ago. So the understanding that the brand is the most important asset of the company has been around for a very long time. When you get into trouble, you need to go back and refocus around your brand and make sure that all the audiences who engage with your brand know what you are offering the market today, that you've got a very clear offering. Research plays a big part in that. When David set up the Ogilvy and Mather office in New York in 48, he came to it from a pretty colorful career. And one part of that career was as associate director for Gallup. And he spent most of his time researching about which Hollywood star should be cast in which, with which script, and which stars in which movies. And all these reports went to the studio heads to determine the best combination to make the most money. And he then took that learning and applied it to fast-moving consumer goods, to countries, to, you know, anything you can think of that can be branded. So your first step when you're in trouble is to go back and look at your research and find out what it is that you need to do next to refocus your brand. And that's called brand rejuvenation, which is on the sheet over there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we haven't managed to speak about the semiotic square, which I would really like to have heard about. Long-term planning, I suppose, and I have a couple of other little creativity, how much that comes into the equation. But we'll have to do another program.
if it doesn't sell, it's not creative. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Mr. Edwin Ward, for coming to talk to us today on University Matters about branding. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.